Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is National Poetry Month. Maya Angelou said about poetry, it's music written for the human voice. And we are going to celebrate poetry this hour. We have many poets we'll be hearing from. We'll have two guests with us. Wisconsin State Poet Laureate will be joining us, and also a poet and distinguished university professor of English language and literature at the University of Michigan will be with us to talk about Adrienne Rich, feminist writer, poet who died last week at the age of 82, and a very powerful poet. I'm just delighted to share this hour with you. We're also asking you to call with a poem that you can read for us. Don't make it really long. We were trying to pick poems that weren't terribly long so we can hear from a number of you this hour as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address, if you'd like to use that, is talk@wpr.org. And we start our conversation with Professor. No, we're going to start our conversation with poems. Oh, we're going to start with a poem. Sorry, we got a lot of poems here. It's a complicated show. Rhonda has to guide me through it so I don't mess up. Adrienne Rich. We're going to start with Adrienne Rich, feminist writer who was known for her poetry, mirrored the times in which she wrote, and it became increasingly political during the 60s and 70s. She was a touchstone poet for the feminist movement, and she died at the age of 82 just last week after a long illness. Adrienne Rich. We'll start our program with what kind of times are these?
There's a place between two stands of trees where the grass grows uphill and the old revolutionary road breaks off into shadows. Near a meeting house abandoned by the persecuted who disappeared into those shadows. I've walked there picking mushrooms at the edge of dread. But don't be fooled. This isn't a Russian poem. This is not somewhere else but here. Our country, moving closer to its own truth and dread, its own ways of making people disappear. I won't tell you where the place is, the dark mesh of the woods, meeting the unmarked strip of light, ghost-ridden crossroads, leaf-mold paradise. I know already who wants to buy it, sell it, make it disappear. And I won't tell you where it is, so why do I tell you anything? Because you still listen. Because in times like these, to have you listen at all, it's necessary to talk about trees.
Adrienne Rich, who died at the age of 82 last week. Linda Gregerson is joining us, author of four poetry collections. She is a distinguished university professor of English language and literature at the University of Michigan, where she teaches creative writing and Renaissance literature. She's won a number of awards for her work, and she is here to talk about poetry and about the writer Adrienne Rich. And thank you very much, Professor Gregerson, for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And God, what a pleasure to hear Adrienne reading that poem.
Wasn't it? She knows how to...
Oh, fantastic.
She knows how to read it, too, doesn't she?
No kidding.
No kidding. You talked about her in an NPR interview I was listening to about how she was, and you can hear it with every word, such a fierce advocate for all who were disempowered on any grounds.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, we heard her political passion earliest on behalf of women, but what was stunning and moving always about her career is the breadth of her advocacy and her sympathy for those who were on the, who got the shorter end of the stick in, you know, every possible dimension of our shared culture.
And who were those people who got the shorter end of the stick?
The poor, those who were of races that were where there was a history of oppression, those whose voices were not heard in the halls of power, And I have to tell you, hearing the news, thinking about her work, rereading it last week, when I was listening, on the other hand, you know, to the NPR reports about the Supreme Court hearings on our badly compromised, you know, pitiful effort to extend health care to those who don't have it in this country, I was thinking how agonized she would be to think that even this small effort was so profoundly endangered.
Mm-hmm. You first encountered her when you were a student at the Iowa Writers' Workshop.
I did. And her work, you know, it was revelatory to me then. I was late coming to it. I mean, I was a full decade late. This was in the mid-70s. She'd been publishing since 1951, but the volume in which her strongest political voice began to be heard was a 1963 volume called Snapshots of a Daughter-in-Law. I was just stunned, you know, to hear how precise her renditions were about the circumstances of those who had been prevented from full articulateness in our culture.
Mm-hmm. She was, I find this so phenomenal, because who wouldn't take such an award? President Clinton was going to give her a National Medal for the Arts, and she said, no thanks.
Absolutely. This was 1997, and it was a pretty breathtaking statement. She wrote a letter at the time to Jane Alexander, who was head of the National Endowment for the Arts, and she said, look, at a period in which in our country the difference between the haves and the have-nots is increasing at such a stunning pace, it seems to me a scandal that we should, in our little privileged part of the nation, be congratulating one another on aesthetic achievement. I mean, and you know, think of what's happened in this country since 1997.
How was she, Linda, a touchstone for the feminist movement?
Oh, well, I mean, she was just a luminary. For one thing, she was loud and clear and brave on behalf of women, and she knew the circumstances of asymmetrical power in this country from a lot of different perspectives. She had had a life as a very young wife and a mother of three children. She knew what that it was to be entrapped in certain kinds of domesticities and expectations. But she also made, at a time when that was very difficult, even more difficult than now, the transition into life as a lesbian in this culture. And so she was minoritized both because of her sex, but also because of her sexual preference. And then she also felt herself sidelined in many ways in this culture as a Jew. So that was, you know, that was a triple identification. Mm-hmm. And it did not, her sympathies did not ever stop with those boundaries, but that was her grounding.
When did you start writing poetry, Linda?
Oh, boy. Well, not many years before I went to Iowa, actually. I was a little late coming to it. I was in my 20s already. So I was still pretty much of a novice when I encountered Rich.
And I'm wondering, as we celebrate National Poetry Month, and I've been reading, I love poetry, and I've been reading a lot of it in the last couple of days. But I was wondering, you know, there's such a breadth of poetry, and some of it seems very direct, some of it seems incredibly complicated. How do we answer the question of what poems are worth our attention? What makes a great poem?
Oh, my God. Well, you know, William Carlos Williams wrote that, you know, it is very hard to get the news from a poem, but people die miserably every day for lack of what is to be found there.
Mm.
And I think that remains a very stirring summons I'm thrilled about the state of poetry in America right now. You're exactly right that there is just a wild spectrum of work being done, some of it immensely accessible and direct, and not all of it politically impassioned by any means, and some of it that takes more patience, I think, on the part of readers, or more slow reading. That is, takes us, we have to grant it that sort of margin of silence so we can listen to what it's really about. My notion is that the poetry, all of us, those who write poetry, that all of us want to write, is that there's no limit to its ambition, either in terms of who it wants to reach, or in terms potentially of philosophical reach or intellectual, but that it also, what it really wants to be, is also immediately available on at least the first level to anyone willing to come to it.
Do you, I don't mean to put you on the spot, and I don't know if you have anything in front of you, but do you have a poem you'd like to read?
If I could read from, if I could read just one stanza.
Of course.
An Audrian Rich poem.
Yes.
And partly because of what it well, you'll see, because of thematically, but also because it is its poetics, its prosody is so brilliant. And this is from that very, again, there's her third volume, which appeared in 1963, the 10-part poem Snapshots of a Daughter-in-Law. And this is just one part of one section. And here it goes. It's about 8 lines. A thinking woman sleeps with monsters. The beak that grips her, she becomes. And nature, that sprung-lidded, still commodious steamer trunk of tempera and mores, gets stuffed with it all. The mildewed orange flowers, the female pills, the terrible breasts of Boadicea beneath flat foxes' heads and orchids.
Oh, very nice.
You know, as a poet, I look at choices just like that little choice of the female pills,
mm-hmm.
right? It's such complex decision-making went into that, and it's actually what you were talking about. It makes it, we all know the kinds of things she's talking about, and yet it's not an abstruse pharmaceutical name. It summons up a whole terrain, and also the fact that it's partly euphemized. So it summons up a whole terrain of women not feeling they could be too explicit about their physical circumstances, and even having those circumstances a little bit surrounded with shame. I mean, she captures it all with elegant simplicity.
Tell us what we should read today, or this month, or in our lifetimes. What should we pay attention to?
Well, of course, we should go back this month, especially, and pay homage to Audrian Rich, who left us such an important legacy. And I think looking at those important early volumes, Snapshots of a Daughter-in-Law, and diving into the wreck from the 1960s and the 1970s is very important. But another woman poet whose name I just want to wave like a flag is Muriel Rukeyser, who, alas, is also no longer with us. And I am thrilled to see that after a period of neglect, my young students are reading her work again with incredible passion. Muriel Rukeyser, let me say that name loud and long.
Muriel Rukeyser, read
Thank
her today.
You. Thank you, Kathleen.
Thank you, Linda. Thank you so much. Linda Gregerson, and you may want to read Linda Gregerson as well, talking about and paying tribute, waving a flag for Audrian Rich, who died last week at the age of 82, and she is well worth paying attention to. We're celebrating National Poetry Month this hour. One of my favorite poets is Seamus Heaney. Rhonda's collected a lot of poets reading their poetry, and we will do that, and we will go to your phone calls. We have a full, I love this on public radio. 4 lines are going with people wanting to read poems. It just doesn't get better. So we'll move on. Seamus Heaney coming up on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. One of my favorite poets is Seamus Heaney, and yes, it may be because I'm Irish, and there's something about Irish poetry that strikes me deep in the heart's core. This particular poem, I have a St. Patrick's Day party every year. I've had one since I was very young, and my mother would have St. Patrick's Day parties, and I went to those as well. You have to read a poem if you come to my St. Patrick's Day party, and I have books of Irish poetry. And I am touched because, and he knows this by heart, my son, who had a terrific high school English teacher, and they studied Seamus Heaney, now reads Seamus Heaney at the St. Patrick's Day party, which brings a tear to my eye. Seamus Heaney was born in 1939 in Northern Ireland. He earned a teaching certificate. He joined a poetry workshop while he was in school and began to write. He is a foreign member now of the American Academy of Arts and Letters, and he held the chair of professor of poetry at Oxford and has taught here in the United States for a number of years. This sort of brings it all together, generations, history. It's one of my favorite of his, and it is titled Digging.
Digging. Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests, snug as a gun. Under my window, a clean rasping sound, when the spade sinks into gravelly ground, my father digging. I look down till his straining rump among the flower beds bends low, comes up 20 years away, stooping in rhythm through potato drills where he was digging. The coarse boot nestled on the lug. The shaft against the inside knee was levered firmly. He rooted out tall tops, buried the bright edge deep to scatter new potatoes that we picked, loving their cool hardness in our hands. By God, the old man could handle a spade. Just like his old man. My grandfather cut more turf in a day than any other man on Toner's Bog. Once I carried him milk in a bottle, corked sloppily with paper. He straightened up to drink it, then fell to right away, nicking and slicing neatly, heaving sods over his shoulder, going down and down for the good turf, digging. The cold smell of potato mould, the squelch and slap of soggy peat, the curt cuts of an edge through living roots awaken in my head. But I've no spade to follow men like them. Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests. I'll dig with it.
Poet Seamus Heaney, from Death of a Naturalist in 1966. We've invited you to join our conversation as well and asked you to read a poem, maybe one that you wrote or a poem that has great meaning for you. And here is our number for you to join our poetry celebration, 800-486-8655. Rich from Sullivan is our first caller. Hi, Rich.
Hi, I'm in Rhinelander.
Oh, you're in Rhinelander. I never know where you are, Rich.
Right. Well, I sometimes don't either. It's hard to choose, but I'd say on any given day, start the day with a poem. And today I'm just going to read sort of a feminist Vassar girl, Edna St. Vincent Millay sonnet, 14 lines. Love is not all. It is not meat, nor drink, nor slumber, nor a roof against the rain, nor yet a floating spar to men that sink and rise and sink and rise and sink again. Love cannot fill the thickened lung with breath, nor clean the blood, nor set the fractured bone. Yet many a man is making friends with death even as I speak, for lack of love alone. It well may be that in a difficult hour, pinned down by pain and moaning for release, or nagged by want past resolution's power, I might be driven to sell your love for peace, or trade the memory of this night for food. It well may be. I do not think I would.
Oh, I love it, Rich, and you read it beautifully.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Langston Hughes, we hear from next. Langston Hughes, born in Joplin, Missouri, and 1902. He has been enormously influential and continues to be. I think a lot of young people read a great deal of Langston Hughes, and they are taken by his work and committed to memory. He has left us with a large body of poetic work. He wrote 11 plays and countless works of prose, including the Simple books. Simple Speaks His Mind, Simple States a Claim, Simple Takes a Wife, and Simple's Uncle Sam. He edited the anthologies The Poetry of the Negro and The Book of Negro Folklore, Langston Hughes.
This is The Negro Speaks of Rivers, one of my earliest poems, written in 1920, just after I came out of high school. The way this poem came to be written was that I was going to Mexico to visit my father, who lived in Mexico City, and on the train going across the Mississippi River, just outside St. Louis, I looked out the window and I saw this great muddy river flowing down toward the heart of the South, and I began to think about what this river meant to the Negro people, how, in a sense, our history was linked to this river, how in slavery time, my grandmother told me that to be sold down the Mississippi was one of the worst things that could happen to a Negro slave. And then I remembered that I'd read about Abraham Lincoln going down the Mississippi as a young man, and he went on a raft to New Orleans, and he saw human beings bought and sold in the slave market there, and he was so horrified by this that he never forgot it. And many years later, of course, we know that it was Lincoln who signed the Emancipation Proclamation. And so, as the train went on into the gathering dusk, because it had been about sunset when we crossed the river, I took my father's letter out of my pocket and began to write down on the back of his letter this poem, The Negro Speaks of Rivers. I've known rivers. I've known rivers ancient as the world and older than the flow of human blood in human veins. My soul has grown deep like the rivers. I bathed in the Euphrates when dawns were young. I built my hut near the Congo, and it lulled me to sleep. I looked upon the Nile and raised the pyramids above it. I heard the singing of the Mississippi when Abe Lincoln went down to New Orleans, and I've seen its muddy bosom turn all golden in the sunset. I've known rivers, ancient, dusky rivers. My soul has grown deep like the rivers.
Langston Hughes, The Negro Speaks of Rivers. We're celebrating National Poetry Month this hour of the program. I think we ought to do this just every day. This is great. And welcoming your phone calls as well. Excuse me, let's go to Mary in Elm Grove next. Hi, Mary.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi, Mary.
Hello. Hello, Kathleen.
Hi, Mary. Go right ahead.
Okay. This is a poem that I wrote in honor of my mother, her birthday is tomorrow, so I thought I'd like to read it.
Oh, great.
It's called April. April is an iris fiercely pushing up through cold soil, parting rotted leaves to make a grand entrance, with purple velvet petals drooping down, inviting all comers. It was Mother's flower. No one else dares snip it. Blooming during her birth month, it was hers. She celebrated these fragile blooms that fade so soon. Then she forgot what a flower was. That's it.
Oh, Mary, you're a poet.
Well, she died with Alzheimer's, so that was why I put that in the poem.
Yes. Thank you. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Let's go next to Philip in Green Bay. Hi, Philip.
Hi there.
Hi.
I'd just like to read something that was passed to me. I'm not sure of the provenance on it, but when I got it, it was attributed to a gentleman who came into notoriety later in his life, Chief Dan George.
Go right ahead.
May the stars carry your sadness away. May the flowers fill your heart with beauty. May hope forever wipe your tears away. and above all, may silence make you strong. Chief Daniel.
Very nice. It sounds like one of those Irish poems. Irish blessings. Thank you, Philip, very much for the call. We're celebrating National Poetry Month, inviting you to share poetry with us, and we're sharing some poetry as well. Gwendolyn Brooks is the next poet we will be hearing from, born in 1917 and raised in Chicago. She is the author of more than 20 books of poetry. She was named the Poet Laureate for the state of Illinois in 1968, and she was a consultant in poetry to the Library of Congress from 1985 to 1986. She died in December of 2000. Gwendolyn Brooks, We Real Cool.
I wrote it because I was passing by a pool hall in my community one afternoon during school time. And I saw therein a little bunch of boys, I say here in this poem, seven, and they were shooting pool. But instead of asking myself, why aren't they in school, I asked myself, I wonder how they feel about themselves. And just perhaps they might have considered themselves contemptuous of the establishment, or at least they wanted to feel that they were contemptuous of the establishment, might want to thumb their noses at the establishment. And I represented the establishment with the month of June, which is a nice, gentle, non-controversial, enjoyable, pleasant, fragrant month that everybody loves. This poem has been banned here and there because of the word jazz, which some people have considered a sexual reference. That was not my intention, though I have no objection if it helps anybody. But I was thinking of music. The pool players, seven at the golden shovel. We real cool, we left school, we lurk light, we strike straight, we sing, sin, we thin gin, we jazz June, we die soon.
Ooh, so a lot of power in that one. Gwendolyn Brooks, We Real Cool. Bruce Dethlefson is joining our celebration of poetry now. Bruce was appointed the Wisconsin Poet Laureate for 2011 and 12. He has published two poetry books, A Decent Read and Something Near the Dance Floor. He grew up in Kansas City, and he completed his undergrad degree in secondary education at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse, his master's degree in curriculum and instruction from UW Oshkosh. He credits a couple of people for his success in poetry. We'll hear about those. He served as the secretary of the Wisconsin Fellowship of Poets for 6 years and has had many poems published in journals and anthologies. Two of his poems were featured on Garrison Keillor's The Writer's Almanac on public radio, and several poems on Your Daily Poem website, which we want to draw attention to because everybody should, myself included, start the day with a poem. Bruce, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be on. This is wonderful.
Isn't this fun?
This is great.
I could just do this every day. Maybe you do this every day.
I'm somewhere in Wisconsin. Yes, I do.
Yeah. What does a poet laureate for the state of Wisconsin, what does that mean to you? What does it entail?
Well, in some states it's an honor, and they have that position for life. I have 2 years, and it's a service position, and my job is to go around and promote poetry and poets all over the state. I visit schools, writing groups, churches, and especially public libraries to get public readings started.
When did you start writing poetry, Bruce?
Probably seventh grade.
Oh.
I wrote just terrible, terrible poetry.
I don't believe that.
Oh, the squirrel in the tree with the key for you and me, and it was just awful. And then in high school, I wrote typical sophomore, why doesn't she love me? Why? Oh, God, why doesn't she love me? But everybody gets, you get through that.
Right. And then something else happened.
And then something else happens, right. You meet some people who actually can write poetry, And they influence your life. John Judson was my instructor at UW La Crosse, and he just opened the whole world for me. I would walk into class, and there would be Denise Levertov sitting in the class. And I thought, well, this just happens all the time. And so he knew every poet in the United States, John Judson did. And they'd be traveling from Chicago to Minneapolis and just come in for the afternoon, George Hitchcock, X.J. Kennedy. And, you know, I just thought everybody did this. And only years later, I realized how fortunate I was.
Oh, isn't it? You can't overstate this. The people who come into our lives, who teach us, God bless them.
Yes. What I like to do when I go to schools, I read some poetry. I think it's really important to see a man up there reading poetry.
Mm-hmm.
I wish that when I was in 7th grade, 8th grade, that some man, or poet, would have come in and read a poem. I try to give kids and adults permission to be artists. We need artists in the good times. We especially need them in the tough times. That's my job. Now, I always thought that poets were dead white guys with beards. You know, and that poetry really didn't have anything to do with my life. But I was wrong. It can save lives. I really believe that.
Yeah, I really believe that, too. And you talk about, you know, I love her, I love her, I love her, the poem in high school. I think in high school, a lot of us really find ourselves drawn to poetry because it helps us go through all the angst of those years, our sexuality and making sense of the world and our future. And if you can just get young people then, or maybe even in 7th grade when they could go beyond squirrels, it makes such a huge difference in their lives, and it carries with them, I think, for years.
Iris, when I was in college, Rod McCune's book came out, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't that great, but Listen to the Worm, right?
Yes,
and
I remember that.
I thought that he had written that book of poems just for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I made a connection, and that's what good poetry does. It makes us connect with other people.
Yes.
And our emotions and validates us. And
mm-hmm.
You mean other people really feel that way?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you have a poem you can read for us?
Yeah, I would like to read a poem by Stella Bloomer. She was a second grader in Sun Prairie last year. And it just demonstrates the simple joy of words. It's called Noel the Mole.
Hmm.
Here is a mole in a deep, dark hole. In this hole lives a mole called Noel. He eats black coal, he plays rock and roll, and that's the whole story of the mole called Noel. He's a hole-dwelling, coal-eating, rock and roll mole. There are about 30 wonderful things right with that poem. I instruct poetry, and that is, we have this, I think we're born with this joy for words. William Stafford says that all poets learn to write in their mother's kitchen. And I remember my mother making up songs and us dancing in the kitchen. And she loved words, and I think it's in my genes somehow.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Hmm. Oh, well, we need to book that second grader, Rhonda. That'd be great. And have you back. You're marvelous. Thank you so much. And happy Poetry Month.
Oh, and to you too.
Yeah. Please come back for an hour. We'll talk to him again for an hour sometime.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Bruce Dethlefson, who is the Wisconsin Poet Laureate for 2011 and 2012. He lives in Westfield, Wisconsin. And you should book him. Yeah, people need to book him so that he can stand up and talk about giving young people permission to be artists. More poetry now. Dylan Thomas. I love Dylan Thomas. He's a dead white guy, but he's from Wales. And a lot of us grew to love Dylan Thomas in high school. He lived hard. He had a pretty tortured life. His father was an English literature professor at the local grammar school and would often recite Shakespeare to Thomas before he could read. He liked nursery rhymes, and he liked Hopkins and Yeats and Poe. He was a neurotic, sickly child who didn't go to school very often, preferred reading on his own. He read all of D.H. Lawrence's poetry, impressed by vivid descriptions of the natural world, excelled in English, reading, neglected other subjects, and dropped out of school at the age of 16 to become a junior reporter for the South Wales Daily Post. He wrote in his late teens, which is amazing, more than half of his collected poems. He came to America for the first time at the age of 35. He did tours of this country, which did a lot to popularize poetry reading as a new medium for the arts. He died very young, age of 39, and became a legendary figure. Most of us know this poem almost by heart. Do not go gentle into that good night.
Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rave at close of day. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Though wise men at their end know dark is right, because their words had forked no lightning, they do not go gentle into that good night. Good men the last wave by, crying how bright their frail deeds might have danced in a green bay. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Wild men who caught and sang the sun in flight, and learned too late they grieved it on its way, do not go gentle into that good night. Grave men near death, who see with blinding sight, blind eyes could blaze like meteors and be gay. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. And you, my father, there on the sad height, curse, bless me now with your fierce tears, I pray. Do not go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the dying of the light.
Dylan Thomas, that guy could read a poem, huh? Like nobody else. Let's go to Ray in Chitek. Hi, Ray.
Good morning, Kathleen. I'm up here working on my old raw wood and stained thirsty cottage overlooking the glistening waters of Potato Lake. It's a beautiful day today.
Oh, how nice.
So, in honor of my younger brother, who was an outdoor education instructor and who took me to my one and only trip to the Boundary Waters, I have six lines that I'd like to say to you as I invite you to sit with me in my canoe.
All right.
Pull as you dip, swing out as you drip. Your paddle leaves ringlets that flee. To the stern they all glide, swirl and blend as they hide. The trail just your memory can see.
Very nice. Thanks for the trip.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go to Karen, Rolling Stone, Minnesota. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you for this show very much. I wanted to reiterate what the poet laureate of Wisconsin said, that poetry is alive and well for children, too. this is a poem that has three very, very short stanzas written by my granddaughter, Emma, last spring when she was in third grade, looking out the window of school on a very rainy morning. Hmm. The first stanza is spring rain. Riding the wind, smelling of fish and worms, plat, plat, platting on the window pane, tip, tip, tipping with tiny fingers, she woke me too early this dark spring morning. Stanza two, the school playground. Swings dance in the wind and rain. One robin waits for the perfect school lunch, night crawlers on a bed of grass. Stanza three, no title. The worm's basement floods. Quick, get out. Uh-oh, robins.
Oh, that is just wonderful. She's going to be, I don't know how old she is now, but she's going to be a very accomplished poet.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks so much for the call. We'll take more phone calls. Momentarily, we'll hear from Nikki Giovanni, too, one of our favorites. We've interviewed her a couple times, and she's a great woman. But we need to pause for a moment. We're celebrating National Poetry Month this hour with many famous poets, and we're inviting you to call in if you'd like to read us a poem as well. And you've just had exquisite contributions. 800-486-8655 is the number. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Nikki Giovanni has been with us a couple times on the air here. She's a world-renowned poet and writer and commentator, activist and educator, and she's been writing for a long time. I first came to the knowledge of her back in the late 60s, I think, early 70s. She's done a lot of recordings. The spoken word, her spoken word really has captivated a lot of people as well. She is a university distinguished professor at Virginia Tech in Blacksburg, Virginia, and she helped bring students together after the horrible shootings there a few years back. She has written some 30 books for adults and children, and this is Nikki Giovanni and the New York Community Choir with Ego Trippin'.
I was born in the Congo. I walked to the Fertile Crescent and built the Sphinx. I designed a pyramid so tough that a star that only glows every 100 years falls into the center, giving divine, perfect light. I am bad. I sat on the throne drinking nectar with Allah. I got hot and sent an ice age to Europe to cool my thirst. My oldest daughter is Nefertiti. The tears from my birth pains created the Nile. I am a beautiful woman. I gazed on the forest and burned out the Sahara Desert. With a packet of goat's meat and a change of clothes, I crossed it in 2 hours. I'm a gazelle, so swift, you can't catch me. For a birthday present when he was 3, I gave my son, Hannibal, an elephant. He gave me Rome for Mother's Day. My strength flows ever on. My son, Noah, built New Ark, and I stood proudly at the helm as we sailed on a soft summer day. I turned myself into myself and was Jesus. Men intone my loving name. All praises, I am the one who would say. I sold diamonds in my backyard. My bowels deliver uranium. The filings from my fingernails are semi-precious jewels. On a trip north, I caught a cold and blew my nose, giving oil to the Arab world. I am so hip, even my errors are correct. I sailed west to reach east and had to round off the earth as I went. The hair from my head thinned and gold was laid across 3 continents. I am so perfect, so divine, so ethereal, so surreal. I cannot be comprehended except by my permission. I mean, I can fly like a bird in the sky.
Nikki Giovanni and Ego Trippin'. Let's go to another listener. This is Mark in Lake Mills. Hi, Mark.
Morning.
Hi.
Hi, this is a terrific program. I'm just delighted to hear this.
I'm having fun, too. A lot of fun.
Yeah, I love the moral poem of Bruce Stethelson's, or his discoverer, I should say.
Yes.
So this is a poem that I wrote maybe partly because it's motorcycle season, and I'm watching the way motorcyclists wave to one another. So this is entitled The Wave. It's those bikers with the black boots and big beards I'm talking about. The ones astride those fat, bright choppers with the chrome motors and the noisy pipes. It's those bikers that, by way of greeting one of their own, extend the left hand in a V just over the thigh and under the clutch. The wave is what they call it, but it's more a signal than a wave, more a sign than a signal. And the message mostly is that they're cool, and they know they're cool, and that they are so oblivious and blissed out and totally hip that this wave is all they can manage, which is a good thing, too. Except these bikers should wave to the plumbers, and the plumbers should wave to the postman, and the postman should wave to the bakers, tinsmiths, tailors, and gymnasts, who should wave to the day drunks, phonies, and spendthrifts, since here in the world, here in the cold, artistic dark, we've all signed on to lose, and now the future's running us down. I'd say that however theoretical and remote, that however cloddish and comfortless, there's a spoonful of something wild in us all, something extravagant and outlaw, and we create such comfort as we find, all of us. We take it, and we give it back again.
Oh, Mark, you're good.
Well, thanks, and thank you for this program. It's just delightful.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I can't believe this audience. This is just great. You're all poets. Little did we know, you're all poets. We got to do this once a week. I do it every day. Thank you so much for that, Mark. That was a good one. It's National Poetry Month. We are celebrating. You can't do a poetry hour without William Shakespeare, right? I mean, he is the master. This is British actor Sam Dastorf. Thank you. Reading Shakespeare's Sonnet 73.
That time of year thou mayst in me behold, when yellow leaves, or none, or few do hang upon those boughs which shake against the cold. Bare, ruined choirs, where late the sweet birds sang. In me thou seest the twilight of such day, as after sunset fadeth in the west, which by and by black night doth take away, death's second self that seals up all in rest. In me thou seest the glowing of such fire that on the ashes of his youth doth lie, as the deathbed whereon it must expire, consumed with that which it was nourished by. This thou perceivest which makes thy love more strong, to love that well which thou must leave ere long.
Shakespeare, Sonnet 73, Sam Dastorf, British actor. We're celebrating National Poetry Month, and let's go to Lori in Milwaukee. Hi, Lori.
Hello, hi, and thank you so much for having this. I love one of your native-born poets there by the name of E. Ethelbert Miller, and I'd like to read Science.
Great.
When you were in elementary school, no one told you about the black laws of cause and effect. Your science teacher failed to teach you about why a police club struck against a black man's head in the South results in a house burning down in the North, or how prejudice can make a store clerk's smile turn into a coldness way below freezing. You often wonder while waiting in line how you can become invisible to every atom in the world. You try to understand the reason for your condition. All the blues you know cannot defy gravity. All the jazz you hear cannot keep you from exploding like a star. Thank you.
Oh, Lori, what's the name of that?
That's called Science by E. Ethelbert Miller.
Very nice.
Isn't it beautiful?
Yeah, it is.
Thank you.
Very strong. Thank you, Lori.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. Mm-hmm.
Let's go to, we got to go to Maya Angelou, who had a birthday yesterday, didn't she, Rhonda? Rhonda was telling me 84? She was 84 years old yesterday. One of my favorite hours, actually, ever was with her when she was on the air. She wound up, do you remember this? It just came to mind. She wound up, somebody called in and said she was getting married, and this was years ago we had her on, and how what a privilege it was to meet her. And she said, would you please get her name and phone number? And by golly, she sent her a wedding present. Maya Angelou sent this listener a wedding present. This hour is making me real weepy. What a thing to do. What a wonderful thing to do. That's who she is. That's who Maya Angelou is. So let's listen to her. This is Phenomenal Woman.
Many people wonder where my secret lies. I'm not cute or built to suit a fashion model size. When I start to tell them, they think I'm telling lies. I say, it's in the reach of my arms, the span of my hips, the stride of my step, the curl of my lips. I'm a woman, phenomenally. I walk into a room just as cool as you please, and to a man the fellows stand or fall down on their knees. Then they swarm around me, a hive of honeybees. I say, it's the fire in my eyes, the flash of my teeth, the swing in my waist, the joy in my feet. I'm a woman, phenomenally. Men themselves have wondered what they see in me. They try so much, but they can't touch my inner mystery. When I try to show them, they say they still can't see. I say, it's in the arch of my back, the sun of my smile, the ride of my breasts, the grace of my style. I'm a woman, phenomenally. Now you understand just why my head's not bowed. I don't shout or jump about or have to talk real loud. When you see me passing, it ought to make you proud. I say, it's in the click of my heels, the bend of my hair, the palms of my hands, the need for my care. because I'm a woman. Phenomenally. Phenomenal woman. That's my mother and all your mothers and my grandmothers and your grandmothers and my great-grandmothers and your greats and my great-greats and your and all you women and me.
Dr. Maya Angelou, one of the most influential voices of our time. She's been called, I love this description, a global renaissance woman. And yesterday was her birthday. She was born on April 4th of 1928. And she is a generous and kind woman. We have time for one more poem, if you can do it in less than a minute. Can you, Matthew?
I can do it. It's Writing by Charles Bukowski. Often is the only thing between you and impossibility. No drink, no woman's love, no wealth can match it. Nothing can save you except writing. It keeps the walls from falling, the hordes from closing in. It blasts the darkness. Writing is the ultimate psychiatrist, the kindliest of all gods. Writing stalks death. It knows no quit. And writing laughs at itself, at pain. It's the last expectation, the last explanation. That is what it is.
Oh, Matthew.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Thank you, Matthew. Thanks so much.
Yep.
Oh, we should just have a big poetry gathering sometime. That was just such an hour. Thank you, everybody, for all of your calls. We'll be posting some things, I don't know what, but some things on our Facebook page, too. Maybe a splendid poem. Maybe we should do a poem a week. How about that? That would be nice, wouldn't it, to do a poem a week? That's the Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for thinking about this and a lot of production work. And thanks to Katie Madsen for doing on-air production. Thank you, everyone, for all of your splendid poems. I am just in awe of your work. There are great poets listening. That is marvelous. That's all I have to say. Have a good weekend. I'll be with you on Monday.